exceptional opportunities CIUT 89.5 FM has to offer.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5.
People here to share the good work that they are doing. Meme, do you want to do the honors?
Yes, we have Samson Brown and Darren Anthony of Secrets of a Black Boy.
Yeah. Yes, yes. What's up?
Can I just say something first?
Please.
I just want to shout out my mother because we were driving down here and she's like, doesn't Drake always sound the same randomly? Randomly. And then she's like, Jay-Z, his singing, it's not that great. And I'm like, Mom, Jay-Z doesn't sing, he raps. Doesn't matter. And I'm like, this guy just made how much money? $5 million off the top for Magna Carta Holy Grail, and my mother randomly just goes off. So, shoutouts. Caribbean moms say the darndest thing. When that show comes out, I'm putting my mom up. I'm just winning it.
I think you just need to make the show.
Yeah. So,
shoutouts to your mom. Yeah. I also have to shout out my parents. It's their anniversary today.
Oh, yeah.
Big love to them.
But
let's get back to the point. Yeah,
I haven't been here for 2 weeks. Yeah.
It's good to have you back.
Thanks,
by the way.
Yeah.
And shout out to Luam and to Victoria and to Adnan. Yeah. We miss him.
Yeah.
But I do want to welcome both Darren Anthony and Samson Brown of Secrets of a Black Boy to the Vibe Collective. Thank y'all for coming through today.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, Secrets of a Black Boy is about to go into its second year of a run, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So Darren are the writer and producer and director?
Director. It's being directed by Kamali Powell, a wonderful director. I'm the playwright as well as an actor and producer as well.
Okay. And Samson, you are...
I'm an actor.
Yes.
No producing, no directing, no other hats, just actor.
Not yet. But certainly the face of the play. As though I was talking to Donna G earlier, she's like, oh, Biscuit!
I want, for those of our listeners who haven't heard of Secrets of a Black Boy, can you just give, a glimpse into what the play is about and why?
Yeah, definitely. So Secrets of a Black Boy, I've been writing it for about a couple of years now, about eight. It's at its heart, it's about five black men that come together for their last supper / domino game, and they talk about all the issues that are going on in the community, whether it be spells of abuse, interracial dating, fatherless. We talk about all the issues that are going on in our community, but it's all about... The arena is basically in a community center, and also we took kind of stories what's going on in Regent Park. As you know, the whole gentrification is going on over there, and it's just kind of like the story is relevant, it's topical, and it's just kind of like their voices haven't been heard, and we want to bring it to the masses. So we've been doing this for a couple of years now, and the story is definitely growing and evolving, and we're happy with the story, and definitely Toronto has been embracing the story, so we're here for our run on July 27th.
Mm-hmm. Now, Darren said it's been a couple of years. It's actually been about 4 years, right?
Since the last show.
Yeah. Samson, can you talk about how you got involved in the show and how it's changed for you from 2009 to date?
I was actually performing at an event that Treya Anthony had at her wellness, health and wellness space on Queen. And she hit me up one day. I'd gone by just to say hi after the performance. And she said, oh, we're getting ready to do auditions for Secrets of a Black Boy. Are you interested? And I was like, yeah, definitely. For sure. Let me know when it's going to happen. So she sent me the information. Sent me the sides, the monologue. I went in, did my audition. Went home. I wasn't really too sure how I did. I didn't know whether or not I actually aced it. I was like, oh, no, I think I messed up a bit. I don't know if I got it. And then I wound up getting the call. And she was like, yeah, we want you. I was like, all right, dope. So that was how I got into the show. And I'd been, every time I'd see Trey before that, when she was doing the kick in my hair, I'd always hit her up and ask her, you know, are there any roles, anything you know about that's going on, any shows, etc. And she said, when I find something, I'll let you know. And then she did. And that was it. And now, apparently, I am Biscuit. That's just it. It was really interesting after doing the show the first time. It was really, really interesting. I didn't expect the reception that we as a whole got, let alone myself as an individual actor within the show got. So I was really surprised. It really warmed my heart to see people come out and actually support and actually want to hear what black men have to say, because I think it's one of the many voices that are not heard, and that a lot of people try and silence, and many people don't really have the patience or the willingness to listen to. So the fact that people are actually willing to come out of all races and all ages across many spectrums to just say, yeah, we want to hear you, that was big. That meant a lot.
Especially in the theatrical context, I think, is very important as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. So you all are having a Q&A next week after the... Is it after the 8 p.m. show?
No, it's after the matinee show at 2 p.m.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about some of the themes that you hope people will be engaging with during the Q&A?
Yeah, definitely. So with the whole Trayvon case going on, we thought it would be important for the community to come out and just talk about what's going on with our community as well as the Trayvon case, and just the themes as well with the play. There's a lot of people who are talking about it and they don't really have a forum to express themselves, so we thought that, you know what, maybe the matinee would probably be ideal. We're going to get a great... right now we're deciding on who's going to be on the panel, but we have some great individuals who are lining up to come up for that. So it's going to be a frank discussion. It's going to be very open. We've got a bunch of different organizations coming out as well. We're trying to target as much as at-risk youth as well, also the LGBTQ community. So it's going to be a frank discussion. I'm definitely looking forward to it as well.
And can you talk about yourself as a writer, how your work has evolved? What was your sort of first creation, and how have you grown through your creative process and through your creative works?
Well, funny enough, I started writing we started writing comedy sketches, and I was working with my sister at the time, and we had like a comedy sketch group called the Platform Entertainment. So similar to like a In Living Color type of thing. And so I just wrote comedy sketches, and before you knew it, I was like, you know what, I want to do something more like serious. I was watching The Kink, I was seeing it go to London, England, I was in New York, I was in LA, and I was watching the play evolve, and I was like, you know what, it would be great to see something like this with men. And I was like, okay, you know what, let me try to write something. And it was a challenge at first, because I've never really written anything serious, but it was just kind of like my environment where I was growing up, as well as being a child and youth worker. I was seeing a lot of serious things going on and the issues, and I was like, yo, these issues need to be addressed. So I started eventually taking a bunch of different writing courses, also just working with my sister, writing stuff. She would critique it, give me notes and whatnot, and before you knew it, like, it took me probably about maybe 3.5 years to actually get like the skeletons of the play. What I wanted to say. Trey also gave me a lot of notes, and I also just was going out and seeing a bunch of different theater, talking to the right people, seeing what the community wanted as well, because I think it's really important to see what is going on, especially when it comes to theater. I think when it comes to theater, there's not a lot of like urban stories told, and I wanted to make sure that I was telling a story, but it was authentic and it was real, and people really can relate to it. So it took a while, but now it's here, and I feel that it's definitely growing. We were in New York last year with a piece, and people think I'm from America, and it's just kind of like, is this a Brooklyn story? And I'm like, no, I'm from Toronto. You know, I think the story just really resonates with a lot of people, and it's definitely evolving, and I'm happy where it's at, and we'll see where it goes from here for sure.
Especially with the theme of gentrification, I know that's something that Brooklyn has been struggling with, Harlem is now dealing with, or has been for quite a while, actually. And then what we're seeing in Regent Park, we've seen it happen in Parkdale. Can you talk about that, the theme of gentrification in Secrets of a Black Boy?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really, it's very important in the piece, because there's thousands of people who are being affected by this, and a lot of people are not talking about it. It's just kind of like the city's kind of like throwing a rug over it, and it's just kind of like, what's going on with these people? How come you're not talking to these people? What are they supposed to do now? And it's supposed to be a 15-year project, and it's just kind of like, how come we're not getting the cover of the newspapers? How come we're not talking about it? And I just feel like this is the right forum for it, but at the same time, I feel like the reporters need to be talking about this a lot more, and the people need a platform to talk about it. So it's definitely important, and it's definitely current.
Thinking about you as a model and an actor already, Samson, the character of Biscuit, was it something that was completely outside of you, or did you have to, like, was it like you had to role play to get into it? Are you still playing Biscuit?
I am still playing Biscuit. I am still playing Biscuit. I know a lot of people are wondering about that. Yes, I am still playing Biscuit.
You just kind of hesitated, so I just wanted to make sure. Like, maybe you're not Biscuit anymore.
No, I am still Biscuit. I am still Biscuit, very much so.
And sorry,
for myself, when we did Secrets, the first time that I was involved in Secrets, because it had been workshop before that, when we first did it, we were in rehearsals. It was really hard for me to tap into what I needed to tap into for the monologue, for it to resonate and for it to be able to really lift off the pages. It was really hard for me, incredibly hard for me. When I was growing up, I had a few good friends, one who was probably a better of a friend out of majority in terms of how much time I really spent with him, how much quality time I spent with him. He was a lot like an older brother to me, so I always looked at him like my older brother. He was trying to make a lot of changes in his life. He had gotten accepted into George Brown. He was looking to get a job and all that kind of stuff, and he unfortunately one day leaving his house, heading to George Brown to go and register and whatnot for school, he stopped off at a friend's house to just chill for a little bit before he left, and he was set up, and they shot him up, and he was murdered. He passed in the ambulance on the way to Sunnybrook. And I grew up on Jane Street, so that happened in Queens Drum. That was in 2004. That same year, earlier on in the year, his best friend had been murdered in an apartment on Gosford. So I've been around it a lot. So it really affected me. And when he had been murdered, he was murdered a week after my birthday, and I was homeless at the time. I saw him 2 days before he died, and that was the last time I saw him. And I knew instinctively that was actually going to be the last time I was going to see him. So it really messed with me a lot, trying to just get into the role. And I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to feel that. I hadn't cried. I hadn't done. I couldn't even go to the funeral. I was only able to go to the viewing. So it was a lot for me. But Kamali is an exceptional director, and he managed to pull what he needed to and let me go where I needed to go and enable me to feel safe to go there, in order for me to bring the character what he needed, in order for it to really be able to touch people the way that it needed to. So I'm really grateful for that, and it helped me heal a lot, because I hadn't dealt with that. I was really angry. I was mad. I didn't want to talk. I didn't want anything to do with anybody for a good while. I pretty much stayed to myself. And that really changed a lot for me. Made me able to face grief that I hadn't been able to.
Right.
So, yeah.
I guess connected to that, you know, there's a lot of people talking about coming to Secrets, and in light of the Trayvon case being, I was going to say settled, we'll say decided, you know, do you all have some concerns about what the energy of the audience on the 27th, on that day? Because there's people coming with this energy, right? Like, I mean, even me, I think I was a little bit unaffected by it for a while, because I knew Zimmerman was going to get off. But I saw this picture on Tumblr the other day of him posing with a young girl, probably a friend of his, and I just started to cry. You know, I just really just started to cry. So there's a lot of energy that will be coming, not just from Trayvon, but like people's personal experiences with gentrification, with shootings, with what it means to be a black man or a black boy living in Toronto and Canada in urbanized spaces. So has that been something that's been on your mind?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not going to label what the energy will be. I just know that people need to definitely have a discussion about it. People have been talking about it for a while, but also another thing is just kind of, there's a lot of cases going on in Toronto and Canada, and they haven't been really been brought to the masses. So I think with this Trayvon thing, it's definitely triggered something,
right.
And people need to have conversations about it. And I'm definitely excited about it. I know I've been talking to a lot of youth. I'm also a child and youth worker, and I've been talking to a lot of youth about it, and they're just kind of like what's really going on? How mm-hmm. do I don't feel protected. I don't mm-hmm. feel like my life is validated, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So it's just kind of like, what are we going to do? So hopefully this forum will definitely help these youth, and I'm really interested to see what their thoughts and views are for sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about that direction of the conversation, because I think one of the interesting things that always happens when something like this goes down, it's like when Troy Davis mm-hmm. was executed, you know, it's like suddenly non-black communities get a glimpse of the reality mm-hmm. of what it means to be faced with racism every day. They get a glimpse, right? And then it's sort of like a passing moment, and then it goes away, and people forget. Mm-hmm. Do you all think that there is something different in this case? Do you think that there is an opportunity to extend this conversation and this dialogue beyond the moment, the heat of the moment? Do you think that, you know, do you all see any hope for continuing this dialogue?
I'm really surprised at the coverage, to be honest mm-hmm. with you. Like, seeing it on CNN, seeing it on these different networks, is just kind of like, wow, they're really talking about this. Like, I think last night I was watching it on Anderson Cooper, and I was just kind of like, oh, wow, they're having, like, real conversations about this. Hopefully this will continue. I don't know if it will, but it looks like it looks like it is. So we'll see what happens. But I'm definitely surprised at where it's going, and I think it's we need to have these conversations more often, because I know this is one case, but there's thousands of cases similar to this. So we just need to have conversations and make sure that we have come up with a conclusion and see how we can better ourselves and move on from this for sure.
Yeah, I think a big portion of a lot of the discussions that are happening is around accountability within communities of color, mm. not just black communities, but mm. communities of color. There's been a lot of conversations around the fact that Zimmerman isn't just a white guy, you know, that he's Hispanic and white, and what does that really mean, and what privilege does he really have as a fairer skinned Hispanic man?
But I think he identifies as a white man. That's what mm-hmm. I heard.
Right. Yeah. See, so it's a lot that's being discussed. As people, like, I'm mm-hmm. seeing people on YouTube, like, comments, like, just back and forth battling left, right, and center on Instagram, on Twitter. Everybody's just going off, right? And I think it's, this case is really forcing people to look at the privilege that they hold. Mm. There was something that happened, I think there was a study that they'd done on Facebook, literally the day after the verdict, there were more unfriendings on Facebook right. than ever in the right. history
yeah,
of Facebook.
Deal,
on what, just because of the conversations people were having, and back and forth, people were just like, oh, it's not really that big of a deal, and why are you really getting that upset, and oh, it's Canada, your children are safe. Like, are you serious? Mm-hmm. Are you really serious? But I think it's causing people to really look at how they relate to not just themselves, but to their children, their friends, how their children relate to their friends, etc., and what it really, really means to be accountable. Do we just get upset because it's a white guy or a Hispanic guy who shot a black child, or do we need to still get up and, like, come out in numbers when it's still black people against black people? And people are thinking, oh, there's more cases of black people killing black people than there is white people killing black people. But no, in any community, it's always people within that community who are, it's a higher percentage of them killing their own versus people from outside killing them, right? Even in the white community, there's more white people killing white people a lot of times than there is people from outside cultures killing white people. So it's like, what are we really discussing right now? What's really the main thing? And I think the main thing right now is just everybody needs to know who they are, not just within the situation, but within the world and their connectedness, and how can they push forward to make sure that they're accountable for themselves and their actions, as well as trying to hold their friends and family accountable for themselves and their actions, right? So it's good. I'm hopeful.
Was looking at me like,
no, because I wanted to ask, has the cast changed at all, and have there been any big changes in terms of themes since the last run?
Absolutely. And I give credit to the amazing director, Kamali Powell. He's definitely taken this play to the next level. He has a great vision. And I'm not going to say exactly what we have done to the piece. Mm. Just know that it's definitely evolved and we're taking a lot more risk, especially with just the writing is definitely evolving and the themes. And we're tackling a lot more difficult situations. Also, we've added Troy Crossfield, who's one of the actors as well. He's new to the team and he's doing a brilliant job. And it's evolving, man. It definitely is. A lot of people are gonna see it, and you're gonna notice the differences for sure. Right. Definitely, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, please don't think it's the same as last time, because it's not.
We can't do that. We're going places.
We definitely didn't go the last time.
And it's just kind of like the bar is raised. I think Trey's always been pushing me to tackle certain situations and issues, and it's just kind of like, with seeing the success of The King and how she was just kind of like, you know what, I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. I'm just going to say how it is. And she's always told me, there's some things that I've written, I was just kind of like, oh, I can't say that. I'm not going to say that. She's just kind of like, why not? You have to say that. Like, it's in your face. Like, people want to hear those things. Like, I find with the Black community sometimes, or even with a writer, it's just kind of like you don't want to say certain things because you don't want to offend people. But it's just kind of like people want to hear those things. It starts conversations, and then why I write is this: I want people to actually leave the theater and be like, okay, why did that come up? Or I wish I could have said that. You know, so it's definitely helpful, and we need to have these forums and conversations a lot more often. And I'm definitely happy where Secret is at this moment.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I remember the last time when I went to go see the play, on that particular night, there was a lot of interracial couples in the audience. And I remember I was close to one, and then when that situation came up, play, people look right, like, to see their reaction. Yeah. And it's those types of things that you want to be able to have people's ability to talk about these things in the open, in a way that is from a different viewpoint. But at the same time, how do we continue to make spaces safe for people as well, too, right? So I think that's where the concern comes as writers, as producers, as directors of as art within Black communities, to talk about these things. It's necessary to do that, right?
Yeah, and I was going to say, I mean, I think that's one of the most important functions of a piece of artwork, that if you're able to get political and you're able to challenge your audience in a way that makes them uncomfortable, then, you know, that's kind of the function of art, because media doesn't do a very good job of that. Media fails miserably every time. I mean, yes, mainstream has been covering Trayvon, but, you know, there's a lot that they're grappling with. I mean, there's some Black journalists who are able to speak to specifics, but even they have to censor themselves. And so there are certain parts of that conversation that need to be highlighted and need to be addressed, like white supremacy and colonization and gentrification, and how those things are all intersecting with what happens to people as they just try and live their lives and then are confronted with racism. And even microaggression, and how do we deal with that? And then the other interesting thing on Indigenous Waves last week, we had Lynn Gale, who is she's an Indigenous researcher and writer, and she has a really brilliant piece called The Ally Bill of Responsibility. And I think it's something that, you know, people need to be looking at, but non-Black people, non-Indigenous people need to be looking at as they are confronted with these issues. Some people have, you know, been confronted with these issues through friends, but there's still certain pieces that they might not understand, and this really speaks well to that.
I think even within our communities, this needs to be. I was in Baltimore last weekend, and I had a very calm argument with my cousin, who's a lot older than me, about how, you know, he is not surprised at the verdict. He thinks it's okay because, you know, Trayvon was clearly a part of a gang and he smoked drugs. And this is my Black cousin, right? So, I mean, even we have to use these things to check each other at times, because, you know, privilege, class privilege, we look at, like, in terms of what happened to Rachel Gentile. I was like, you know what I mean? So you lose your best friend and you're expected to be like ho-hum and all calm. So, I mean, I think these are things that we need to check ourselves, and when I say ourselves, within our communities on too, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. And I think, especially with the Rachel Gentile situation, I think one of the key things that is that I noticed within the court case as I watched a bit of it unfold, because I hadn't been able to watch the majority of it,
mm-hmm.
But I noticed that while Creole and Spanish are her first two languages, English being her third language, she didn't have a translator.
Mm-hmm.
There was another lady who wound up testifying, who was another, I hesitate to choose between Hispanic or Latina, but because at this present moment, I'm not sure exactly which one is the most politically correct, so I don't really want to offend, but she had a translator,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know whether it was a choice of Rachel's to not have a translator, even though English was not her first language, or whether it was something where they just didn't think to get her a translator. I don't know. And I think one of the things that we really need to work on a lot of times is the pride that we have. I mean, we don't want anybody to look at us and say, oh, well, I can't speak, or I can't do this, or I can't whatever. And then unfortunately, sometimes we wind up in situations, whether it's by our own choosing or somebody else's choosing, not able to properly represent the truth in the way that we want to be able to represent the truth, because not everybody can, as some jurors say,
yeah.
understand the words that we use or the way that we speak or whatever the case is, right? And I think that's a key thing that we need to always know and be able to be aware of. Where are we needing help, or where are we needing to tone down some of our own pride? Because pride really only gets us so far in a lot of situations. And I think pride is one of the reasons why a lot of times we don't ask for help. We don't do a lot of things that we should be doing, but we don't do, right? Which can help better our cases and better our situations in order for us to progress as a people. I think a lot of times our pride sometimes gets in the way, right? And I think that's something that we also, as a community, need to check ourselves on.
And the grief that she was experiencing.
Yeah, right? It's a lot.
Has she got proper grief counseling?
Yeah, you know? She probably didn't. You know what I mean?
That's the thing. And she was talking, I saw an interview with her, with I think it was Mark Lamont Hale, and she speaks English fine. You know, my thing is that she's probably angry and provoked,
yeah.
you know, by, and that's part of the strategy of the defense, is to try to get this witness kind of,
mm-hmm.
you know, off their game in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yeah, I'm pretty sure that Trayvon hit first, you know, in her thing, but it's kind of like, but he was being followed and harassed,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and he was likely frightened, you know, in the sense that, and maybe there might have been some machismo involved in it as well. But for me, it spoke to the idea of, like, and going to the idea of gentrification, is like how people are policing these neighborhoods.
Right.
And Zimmerman did one thing. Okay, he did what he did. But then you also have six people who said, yeah, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's okay. So what exactly is happening in that situation? And to me, I look at it as there's a history of, like, a negative correlation between having black people and your property value in North America.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this young black man in this gated community where he has a right to be, but doesn't really have a right to be.
Right.
And so mm-hmm. here you have this hothead who's going to come and do whatever and protect their property value. This is just me just thinking, talking out loud on the radio, right? I haven't really gone through this. It's more a hypothesis. But mm-hmm. if you look at the history and you look at the dynamics of it and you look at how court cases have been used to enforce certain social economic policy, it's not out of left field. It makes sense to a degree. So I looked at it for a while, been looking at it like, yeah, they just didn't want these people in their community. They have this youthful guy in some capacity. Yeah. I mean, his dad is like, what, a magistrate judge? Like, yeah, he doesn't know, like, he doesn't know anything about the law. Like, you know, he's got to know something at least, you'd think. And so, yeah, I mean, that's how I kind of looked at this situation, as something to do with property value more than just the simple race issue, you know, but race is linked to all those things, of course, in the States particularly.
I wanted to actually come back to a point because I think we have to be careful of, like, yeah, we're, you know, this issue's in the media a lot, but I find that a lot of the coverage is being manipulated, and how it's being used is very disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I didn't watch the court. I refused to watch any of George Zimmerman's coverage just because I found anything, anytime I turned it on, it was vile. Like it was, it felt like assault, mm-hmm. really. So I had the same kind of feeling where I kind of knew he was going to get off. His father's a dead judge, which no one even talked about during the coverage at all. So I think yes, it's in the media a lot, but we have to question, why is it in the media, and what is that image on certain communities? What is it illustrating, kind of thing? But anyway, I wanted to go back to the play. Basically, my question is, how was sort of the process of incorporating new things? Did you work with the director? Was the actors involved? What did that kind of look like?
It's a collective of things. Definitely trying to stay in the know by trying to read as much as possible. Go out and see a bunch of different projects, whether it be film, theater. But also, I think the biggest thing is just working with the cast and the director. The most difficult thing for me was writing the father piece. And collectively, we came together and we made that piece brilliant. It came off the page, and it was just kind of like everyone had their own views on it, and everyone had their own experience with it. So it was just kind of like, okay, you know what? Like, maybe we should put this in there. Maybe we should put that in. There was just no egos. It was just kind of like, okay, you know, this is real. This is authentic. This is what we need to say. And I give credit to the cast, the director. Samson also had some great feedback on it as well. And it was just kind of like, it's definitely evolving as a piece. And if it wasn't for the guys there, I don't think it would be where it's at right now, for sure.
We have to go to a very quick break, but I hope you guys will stick around, and we'll talk to you on the other side of the break. It's going to be real fast. Mm-hmm. I want to remind the listeners, you're listening to The Vibe Collective, and we'll be back after these very brief message on CIUT 89.5 FM.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we're back here on the Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're speaking with writer Darren Anthony and actor Sam.
That's short, eh?
I told you it was going to be short.
Wow.
I told you. Everybody thinks they have all the time in the world during the break. They all, like, change their clothes and go cook a meal. It's not like that.
Drew says she sets it up so people get a catch.
So we're also speaking with actor Samson Brown. They are both visiting us today to talk about the play Secrets of a Black Boy, which takes place next Saturday. There's a 2 p.m. showing and then an 8 p.m. showing. Yes. And
at Daniel Spectrum, 585 Dundas Street East
in Regent Park.
Yes. Yeah.
That's right.
Tickets are still $25 for matinee, $30 for evening. And you can go online, secretsofablackboy.eventbrite.ca to order tickets online using a credit card. If you do not have a credit card and would like to do email money transfer, you can email secretsofablackboy.email@gmail.com or hit me up on Facebook, hit up Darren, hit up anybody in the cast on Facebook, and we all have hard copies of tickets, so hit us up.
Now, I wanted to ask you all, because you are doing the community talk back next Saturday after the matinee show, but clearly this is a play that speaks directly to some very important issues that are facing young Black youth. Is this something that you would like to take to schools? Do you want to be able to use this as an educational tool? Is that something you've thought about at all?
Absolutely. For the last 3 years, Trey and I have been going to the schools for February for Black History Month and just talking about our work. Also working with the drama classes and doing snippets from our plays as well. But I would definitely want to bring the full piece together and maybe go on a school tour. we're taking steps and seeing how we can make that work. But for the most part, we'll see if after. I think there's some possibilities in the States first before we actually do it in Canada. Some people are interested over there, but I really want to do it in Canada because Canada's. I'm from here, and it's just kind of like, you know, this is our story. So why not do it here first?
Definitely. And I was just reading this really interesting story on a neighborhood in Brooklyn where they've had 363 days without a shooting, without a killing, and it was because of a community movement that's happening there that's engaging the youth. If they're going into they're already in the community, they're people from the community. If they hear about any kind of beef or whatever, they're addressing it directly, like talking to the people and sort of facilitating talk and facilitating different options. And it just made me think about not just your play, but, you know, community work and how effective that is. It's so simple, but it's so effective in so many ways. If youth are given other options, if they're given even the opportunity to talk about this stuff that they're going through, Samson, as you said, you know, what you went through, and not having the opportunity to process that, not having the opportunity to talk to anybody about that, and what that does to you as a person, what that does to your heart, to your soul. Getting back to the point that, you know, I feel strongly that art is a really effective way of addressing these issues. And as you say, you know, going into the community that you're from and taking this story there is really important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. They said the revolution would not be televised, right?
Yeah.
So gotta find different ways for it to speak to the masses.
I was wondering, you had mentioned being in Brooklyn, and you're heading to North Carolina in 2 weeks, a week and a half?
Yeah, about a week and a half,
yeah. Mm-hmm. How did you get to North Carolina? I mean, Brooklyn makes sense to me, but North Carolina is a little different.
Well, to be honest with you, I've been researching this the festival for a couple of years now, and I know it happens every 2 years, and I was just kind of like, before Trey brought her play to North Carolina 2 years ago, and it did really well up there, and it was just kind of like, I researched it, and I was like, yo, Trey, I really want to bring my play here first, you know, it's definitely a great platform. So she had some people that she knew, she applied, she got her play in it, and it was just like, okay, you know what, it did really well here, maybe you should do it here next year. Mm-hmm. So I applied, since Trey raised the bar with her play, and they were like, okay, you know what, maybe this play is pretty good. They read it and they loved it, and they're just like, yeah, we'll definitely have it. We'll make sure that you guys close the festival. So,
oh wow,
yeah,
that's pretty awesome.
I just want to, for our listeners, because you've referenced your sister a few times in the conversation, but we haven't actually broken it down for anybody who's not aware that your sister is Trey Anthony, who is the creator and writer of The Kink in My Hair, and among many other good works that she's done, including the Healing Center that you referenced earlier, Samson.
Yes.
So clearly your sister is a big influence in your life.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Do you want to talk about the relationship you have as writers and siblings?
It's a little bit of a sibling rivalry, but, you know, I'm not going to lie, but I love my sister to death. She's definitely the biggest influential people, the most influential person in my life. She just told me that, you know, the pen is where the power is, you know, it's acting is cool and whatnot, but at the same time, it's just kind of, when you put your thoughts on paper, they can definitely evolve. And, seeing the play, The Kink in My Hair, grow, I was there when it was just like in a small little library, you know, and now it was like, it was in the Princess of Wales Theater, it was in LA, it was in New York, it was in San Francisco, and I was like in the front row in every single performance, and seeing the new actors, like I knew their lines before they knew their lines. I would see the performances, I was like, yo, you know Trey, you know she missed her line, right? You know what I mean? So I knew that. I was on it, and I was like, okay, you know what, like I need to start telling my story because I feel like I have something here. But Trey, I love her to death. She's my everything, and I owe everything to her for sure.
That's kind of beautiful.
So there's something that you talked about in your process in terms of researching and seeing other plays, and now that you share this about seeing someone miss their line, how do you operate now in secrets? Because there's a certain amount of holdback you have to have to let people.
Yeah, I
wish there was like a webcam here. People saw the exchange of looks between Samson and Darren. Drinks water. Okay.
Well, Well, I give credit to Kamali Powell. Because now that I'm wearing three hats, the producer, the writer, and actor's hat, Kamali said, as soon as you walk through that door, you're just an actor.
Straight
so
up.
So if someone was doing their lines and I might have noticed that they've skipped a line, I'll just look at the director. I'm not even really going to look at the actors. But most of the time, the actors will come up to me like, yo, Darren, I'm sorry. You know?
we're gonna get some confirmation on that from Samson.
Yeah. It does happen. It happens a lot. Darren, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry.
And once in a while, I'll pull him to the side and say, yeah, you know you missed it, and I really want you to stress that line. So, you know, yeah. But the Kamali just puts me in my place. And be like, Darren, it's just you're just an actor today. So it's cool. It's definitely cool.
A lot of fun.
Are you working on anything new?
I am. I'm actually working on the feature film of Secrets. I'm also working on a short film. It's kind of like a comedy. I haven't given it a title yet, but I'm always writing. I'm always trying to create different content. I really want to make Secrets into a feature film. Hopefully I can meet the right people and they can help me bring it to the next level. But it's always good just to exercise the brain and try to do as much research as possible and start to stay in the know. And always writing is definitely important to in my life.
Mm-hmm. Samson, are you working on anything new?
I think I'm always working on something. At present, right now, I myself and my business partner, Ashley Iris Gill, also known as AIG Pro on Twitter, We started a small production company called the Inner Eye Collective, and we're trying to, right now, photography, videography. We just came back from Baltimore. We were doing work on in April we went down to Baltimore to do some work on a documentary, a lot of behind the scenes stuff. So I've picked up the camera and fallen back in love with it. And we were working with a company called Black Powerful Women, which is based primarily in Baltimore, but also in Atlanta, with a lady by the name of Michelle Blue. So we were working on a documentary about a woman by the name of April Sims, who's a hairstylist and who has like completely transformed a lot of what's happening in Baltimore within hair and all that kind of stuff. So just that right now, and we're working how to get youth that are interested in the arts, in the behind the scenes, a lot of behind the scenes stuff, the photography, the videography, to be able to mentor them and get them in the right direction, whether it's through programming and stuff like that we can partner with. So between that and right now, I'm working with a program called Success Beyond Limits, which is based in the Jane and Finch area primarily. So within that quote unquote priority neighborhood, teaching a drama class at York University for grade 8 transfer students. And transfer students are what the TDSB has kind of put together a study that they did on what they call the 16 by 16, and the results of that study were basically that youth who by the time they hit 16 years of age haven't acquired 16 credits are at a higher percentage rate in terms of their likelihood to drop out of school. So this is to try and get the youth that, because they no longer fail students in grade 8, they pass you anyways. So this is a program set up where in the daytime the youth are in classes, so English, math, etc., to try and get their scores back up so that they're ready to go into grade 9. In the afternoon, they do things like drama with myself. There's a dance class with, I believe, one of Sean Desmond's backup dancers. They play basketball, tennis, they go swimming, they do all kinds of stuff. And that's what they do in the afternoons. And then when they finish the 6-week program, they graduate, and for those who have kept their attendance up and they're on point, they leave the program with one credit under their belt. So they're walking into grade 9 already with a credit under their belt. So that's what I'm doing right now, and I'm really passionate about it. I grew up in Driftwood, so that's my heart. That's my home right there.
How do you feel? Because when I first heard about this decision by the TDSB to not fail students, how do you feel about it? Do you feel like it's the way in which it's being addressed is the best route to take?
You know, I don't I don't really know whether or not it's the best route or not the best route. I know that failing, for some students, having a report card with a big F on it actually changes something for them. Mm. For some students, that it does absolutely nothing, right? Each person is completely different. Just like in class, some people learn visually, some people learn orally. Everybody learns differently. I think in order for a decision like not failing students to properly work, I think there needs to be a lot of programming and support and working with the community to be able to keep students actively attentive in class and wanting to pass. I'm not sure right now how many programs there are in the city like that. From what I know, Success Beyond Limits is, I believe, the first and only right now of its kind within the GTA. So there's nothing else from what I know in any other neighborhoods. So a program like Success Beyond Limits is a great program. If there could be more, that would be exceptional. If there could be tutoring programs set up where older students from some of the high schools come in and work with some of the younger students to get their grades up, I think that would be excellent. I mean, there's a lot that could happen, but it's all baby steps, and right now it's still testing stages, right? So I think a decision to not fail students, it can harm some, and with proper programming, I think it can benefit all.
Mm. And curriculum reform.
Mm-hmm.
But that feels like a better solution to me than not failing a student. Because I did a program up in Jane Finch area, and I just... How are you going to go to high school? How are you going to go to high school? You can't read, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. So that's why I feel like curriculum... But we have to be... when we can, more hyper-vigilant as community members on how we can push these things. Like, I have a godson. He's just stupid brilliant. Like, he was talking to me about the plane crashes the other day, right? Like, giving me information on it, right? Like, but we have children. We have our black children who goes into these schools like this, and then they're not passing grades, but they're passing grades, right? So I definitely believe that curriculum development is the way.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely. And I think one of the key things, too, in classrooms that need to really be addressed with a lot of how the curriculum is set up is really honoring and respecting and acknowledging the fact that every student learns differently.
Right.
Standing at the front of a classroom and just reiterating a spiel that you've been taught to do every single year is not how every student learns. Right, there's many students when I was in elementary school that none of us were stupid,
right?
But at all, period. But if you stand in front of a class and you just lecture, and I learn visually, listening to you for an hour in class is not going to teach me anything. I'm not going to learn. I'm not going to be able to take in anything. I'm going to have to sit at home with my textbook and read, and that's what's going to work for me. Right, and some other students work best by bouncing ideas off of other students. So penalizing a student because they happen to be talking about what you're discussing in class with another student doesn't always work. Maybe that student does learn like that. Maybe working through a problem, they're not seeing it, they bounce it off another person, it works for them, they're like, oh, I see how you got that. But standing in front of the class isn't going to do that every single time, right? And I think that's something that really needs to be acknowledged, that not every student learns the same. You put you can't put a fish and and a cat and tell them both to climb a tree and expect that the fish and then judge the fish because it can't climb the tree. You can't do that. It doesn't make any sense, right? You gotta find new ways to teach them, mm-hmm. and every student deserves that. And I think that is where the greatest success can come out of a lot of the students. And I think where you'll see a decrease in the amount of students failing is when you actually honor the fact that they learn differently, because there's no child that's stupid. There isn't a single child that's stupid. Whether a child can read at the age of 10 or not read at the age of 10, child is not stupid. There is some way that child learns, and you need to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And if you're not willing to take that time, then maybe possibly teaching is not actually your calling. Mm. Because you need to actually love a child's mind and want to see it grow and mold it in order for you to really, I think, be an effective teacher. If you don't have that passion, then you're gonna lose a lot of children.
But
to
then
this,
there's
in
an
the
expectation
system, right?
of a certain amount of activism for educators. Where right. I've spoken to colleagues and friends. Well, I shouldn't say colleagues. I'm not a teacher, but friends who are teachers, and they feel like there isn't room. Capacity in which to have that activism because of the structure of the TDSB, right? I'm not sure about other school boards. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of parents now who are looking to alternative schools.
Yes.
What did Junior call homeschooling? Something learning. I can't remember the term he used. Life learning.
Yes. Life learning. And but that's exactly the point, is that we have this system. It is colonial. It is Eurocentric. And it is definitely designed for streamlining people in a very particular way into mm-hmm. very particular paths in life.
And you also get the fact that not every parent wants the same thing for their child. Mm. There are a lot of people who want their children to just march through the system and go on into university and have this,
And not criticize it.
Not
or
criticize anything. We don't want you. We don't want any trouble. We came here.
Don't
you're supposed to do well. You're supposed to be a doctor. You're supposed to be a lawyer. And those people who aren't learning, don't be friends with them. Or there are all these kind of layers involved in a typical classroom dynamic. And a lot of times it's reflective of class aspirations. Mm. Mm-hmm. And class in the sense of not the school class, but what people want out of life in a sense, and what takes precedence, yeah. So even within, we're talking before about within the idea of community and the conversations we have in community, it's kind of like, well, what do we want as a community? Do we really want our kids to be educated as a community, or in which kind of ways we want them to be educated, mm-hmm. is a conversation, right? Because I think back to my experiences in the classroom, and I encountered a number of black parents, and they were kind of like, yeah, well, they just have to become a dentist. It's kind of like, well, she just paints all day. Like, that's what she does. Like, she's just kind of probably not, that's not really another thing. Not trying to hear it, right? So it's like pressure, the school is very important. The community is as important in terms of schooling. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times you see happening in the school mainly just amplifies opposed to creates.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's great that Secrets is going to, the plan is going to school, because I feel like, I had a great white woman, great drama teacher in grade 10 who took me to see the ballet. Never went to see the ballet before, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of, and I'm thinking about my brother, like a lot of black youth, they don't necessarily get exposed to the theater, right? In the way that, some of us have experienced the kink, right? So I think it's these spaces in which people can see, young children can see, other black men doing theater, and it's them and it's not them.
Yeah, it's very important to change the theater, because, the theater, like a lot of media, doesn't have the most positive historical background, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of like where we get blackface from. Right. So we get, mm-hmm. even now when we look at minstrelsy and we look at, what's happening on TV, a lot of that stuff comes from traditions in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this very important push to be able to reclaim that space, because every culture, every tradition has theater,
mm-hmm.
right? But as it's been practiced in North America has been for a very particular purpose, shall we say, a very peculiar purpose, shall we say. So it's great that these things are like Kink and Secrets of a Black Boy and other plays. I saw one, I think Madupe had a play. I think they just finished its run. That we're seeing these plays, and we're kind of reclaiming this space in a sense of where you can go to spark education, to spark conversations, etc.
On learning.
Definitely.
And hopefully amongst the parents too, because that point you made is really critical.
Yeah.
If parents are not empowered to think outside of that system, because a lot of parents who are coming from the Caribbean, they're coming from extreme colonial indoctrination and that extreme pressure to not rock the boat, especially if you're moving to a new country, let's just fit in and get our little piece of the pie.
Certainly, and financial pressures, right? Because people don't often see the immediate payoff of the arts, right? It's like, it's not going to get you steady employment. Oftentimes, it's not going to get you these things. So people will be like, well, that's great. Do that as a hobby, but sciences or whatever. And it's like, you know, that doesn't always, that's not always good for people's soul, and it's not entirely true, is that you can, there are ways to make livings in the art and ways to organize your life in the arts. Mm-hmm. And people need to, I think, as theater grows in particular, and we're having these conversations, maybe more of those channels will become available. But a lot of people, it's kind of, they take this kind of attitude where, you know, if you can walk, you can dance. If you can talk, you can sing kind of attitude, and it's not that big of a deal. Mm. But in fact, it's a huge deal, because yeah, this is where we actually learn to be people and learn agency and learn all these other things. So it's hopefully, you know, theater in general continues to grow.
Yes. I just wanted to to actually mirror your point. But when people start with that line where, you know, it's only stories that your thing, and what question I want to ask them is like, go through your day and don't tell a story to anybody.
Right.
Just go through your daily life. Don't tell a story to anybody and see if that happens.
Right.
Can't.
Don't tell them how you got from your house to work. Don't tell them nothing. Yeah. Not a thing. Just don't say anything and see how it really works. It's hard. It's very hard.
Exactly. Well, we are pretty much at the end of our hour. So I want to thank you both for coming through today. It's been really, really illuminating having this discussion with you and talking about art and how it intersects with the community responsibility to create these dialogues that are really, really important and empowering.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for the work that you're doing. Once again, Secrets of a Black Boy is taking place next Saturday at 2 p.m. and then again at 8 p.m. And it is at the Daniel Spectrum Theater, which is in Regent Park.
I'm just trying to 585 Dundas Street East.
If people want tickets, they can go to secretsofablackboy.eventbrite.ca. They can also hit you all up for hard copy tickets.
Yes.
They can send an email transfer.
Yes.
Yes.
Add me on Facebook, Samson Brown. I'm always doing something.
So any last words before we sign off?
I'm looking forward to seeing you all on July 27th. Definitely come out and support us before we head off to the National Black Theater Festival in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for all the support and love. It means a lot to know that people actually want to hear what we have to say. So thank you for not silencing us.
Yes. Well, thank you for coming by and sharing your voices with us. Mm-hmm. It's been really good having you here. So we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we do have these roundtable talks. We talk about things like social justice, oppression, anti-oppression, decolonization, identity,
environmental racism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And mass culture's manipulation of the adolescent, pre-adolescent, and adult minds, otherwise through the medium of celebrity gossip.
Yeah. That's how we do it here on the Vibe Collective every Saturday. And then from 4 to 5, the DJs bring you music to move you.